members of the Commonwealth Club, and guests, when we consider with both hope and fear the achievements and the problems which will follow from the development of science during the war, we look for enlightenment to the scientist, to the journalist, and to the philosopher. In Dr. Gerald Wendt, we have all of these experts in one person. As a scientist, Dr. Wendt is distinguished for his research work. He was formerly the research director of Standard Oil Company of Indiana, formerly also dean of the Department of Chemistry and Physics of Pennsylvania State College. As a journalist, he has written and edited a number of textbooks on scientific subjects, and at present is the full-time technical advisor to Life, Time, and Fortune. That he is a philosopher is evident to anyone who has followed his writings and his speeches, in which it is apparent that he's more interested in the impact of science on the human being than he is on the abstract science itself. Dr. Wendt has come to the Bay Region under the auspices of the Committee on Economic Development. We have the pleasure of having as our guest today Mr. R.E. Fisher, who is the regional chairman, and Mr. Frank Belgrano, who is the chairman of the Western District of the Committee on Economic Development. With pleasure that I introduce the Commonwealth Club of California, Dr. Gerald Wendt, who will speak on science in wartime and post-time and post-war living. Dr. Wendt.
Mr. Charles, gentlemen, that's an embarrassing welcome. Because I know that it is only in very recent months that the public has been so excited and so deeply interested in what is going on in the science laboratory. I always speak with some hesitation because I know that I have on my shoulders the responsibility of speaking for a group of men who are molding our future, whether we like it or not, and who very seldom have the chance to speak for themselves. In fact, they are not usually very eager to appear in public, and they don't altogether sympathize with my doing so. But, as Mr. Charles has said, I do so because I am gravely concerned about the great gulf that there is between the men in the laboratory and the public. And so I much appreciate this opportunity. When we get through with converting from wartime to peacetime, from war industry to peace industry, then we shall have to convert once more and convert from the science of pre-war days to the science of today. That is a very grave challenge, and the possibilities are enormous, both for harm and for good. I think that American business has faced the problem of immediate reconversion from war to peace with much courage. I have admired for years the splendid cooperation that the Committee for Economic Development has achieved in almost every hamlet of this country, with 3,000 committees organized throughout it, bringing together both the local and the national point of view. I think they have stressed that it is not only a conversion from war industry to peace industry, but more than that, more difficult and more important than that, the conversion from one customer to millions of customers. They have, I think, convinced businessmen throughout the country that there is just as much purchasing power in the United States when it is exercised by a million purchasing agents than as there is when it is exercised by a group in Washington. They have encouraged us to solve our own problems and to look forward with confidence. The kind of cooperation that has been obtained on a county scale, on a state scale, and on a regional scale, as exemplified by their organization, means much to the country. I think we can face that kind of reconversion with real confidence. But then come into our factories, into our stores, into our homes, into the minds of our children and under our very skins the new ideas that science has been putting forth, many of them still unpublicized. In wartime, we need science. We need power. And the only source of more and more power is more knowledge. And the only source of more knowledge is scientific research. And consequently, we have organized science on a tremendous scale. There are in this country now at least 100,000 highly trained expert scientists that work in research in the universities, in the government laboratories, and in industry. They spent last year at least, almost $1 billion, not on building factories, on production, but on research itself. It is a major industry. No wonder that we have magnificent new weapons. No wonder that in the hands of our soldiers and sailors and Marines, executives, they have furnished the requirements for victory. But also, no wonder that after the war, when they come to us as consumers, our ways too will change, just as they've changed over and over on the fronts, in the air, on the sea, and on land. The weapons have made the difference. Science has made the difference. It'll make a great difference to us. I don't want to be spectacular because I know that I conceded my function here, and whenever I speak, and whenever I write in our publications, to be just as meticulous about debunking, deflating the fantastic, almost spectacular ideas that some uninformed science writers have, to deflate those as to bring you up to date. So I don't want to be spectacular, but I don't mind saying that I am sure that we shall have more changes in the way we live in the next 10 years than we've had in the last 50 years. In the way we live, in the way we spend our dollars and our days, in the way we treat our children and educate them, in the way we treat our neighbors across the seas and nearby, because of the great powers that science will release. The greatest, the most spectacular certainly of them, is the atomic bomb. I'm not going to talk very long about it because it is a distant project. It is impossible to overemphasize the ultimate consequences of atomic power. But it is possible, it is easy, to get too excited about it now. Atomic power will have no influence on anybody outside of military and international political circles for another 10 years, let us say, and we'll have plenty of problems before then. The atomic bomb, I suppose, ended the war. Certainly, it shortened the war. I was rather distressed when Secretary Burns said recently that the war was won without the atomic bomb. If that is true, then perhaps we should not have used it, not have killed 150,000 civilians. But I doubt whether it's true. Certainly, it shortened the war, saved American lives, and probably, in the end, saved as many Japanese lives as it took. However, it's powerful, it's quick, it's concentrated energy, and it's terribly expensive. We have to, before we can use it commercially, we have to unconcentrate it. We have to be able to use it in small doses, in droplets, in pellets. We use them, burn them as we wish, where we wish. That is not now possible. It will take much more research to solve that difficulty. And then, too, it is much more expensive than it can possibly be for industrial and commercial use. Both of those problems are big. If the bomb shortened the war by 8 days, then it saved us $2 billion. That's what we spend every 8 days. And in that case, we were justified in spending $2 billion in its manufacture and development. And in that case, perhaps we are justified in saying, if it saved us those 8 days and saved us $2 billion, let's spend another $2 billion on it and hurry the day when it will be useful. We won't do that. I don't think we'd be ready for it if we had the answer in a year. But I do hope that we will spend $100 million on it per year for 10 years, and then in 10 years have an explosive that can be used when, if, and as we wish, and it will be cheap. It is true that one atomic bomb is more powerful than 20,000 tons of TNT. Yes, but it is also much more expensive than 20,000 tons of TNT, and far more expensive than 20,000 tons of coal or of oil. Therefore, we need to slow it down so that we can use it at will, and we need to make it cheap. I don't know how they will be done. I think that slowing down is a relatively small job. I think it can be brought under control maybe in 2, 3, 5 years of research. Making it cheaper is another thing. Ultimately, while it is still quite expensive, I suppose it will be used where fuel can cost an awful lot, and does cost an awful lot. And that, outstandingly, is in the aviation industry, in the airlines. The cost of the gasoline burned by a plane is not important, but the cost of hauling it thousands of miles across the sky, many, many tons of fuel, that is very high indeed. And if 1,000 gallons of gasoline weighing 6,000 pounds, weighing 3 tons, therefore, could be replaced by a relatively weightless fuel, weighing a few ounces or a small fraction of an ounce, then we, that same plane, of course, would carry 3 tons more in passenger or freight load, and would the cost of flying would be very remarkably reduced. And so I think it will first be used in jet planes, perhaps, shooting its energy, its heat, out the rear end by heating a stream of compressed air so that it expands and shoots out as a hot plane heated by atomic power and not by combustion. That will be the first use, in my opinion. Then, as it gets cheaper, it can be used in gas turbines. Same type of engine, but the hot flame absorbed in the wheels of a turbine, spinning it, and thereby spinning the propellers of a plane or the propellers of a ship or the wheels of a locomotive. If it comes down cheap enough, the powerhouses will use it. The utilities and all great power stations there first and there for years, because it will certainly take competent physicists and engineers to run such an atomic engine. So I sketch this briefly because I want to postpone any interest in the atomic bomb. Perhaps by the year 2000, we shall have it in pellet form, perfectly safe and harmless, so that we can burn it in our furnaces and in our automobiles. I don't know. The year 2000 may bring. I shan't live that long. Ultimately, yes, free power. Power as free as the air you breathe. I don't think any of us will live to see that day. Ultimately, I guess it'll come. And then what? Oh, then the world is an entirely different place. Let me give you just one imaginary example. Nothing fantastic. Oh, we've had fantasy. My good friend David Deeks of the Scripps Hard Papers printed a beautiful story about taking a little speck of this stuff and sticking it to the top of the Empire State Building and letting it shine like the sun, day and night. So we'd never have any night in New York, and no nightclubs, and no night business, and therefore no New York. Those are fantasies. My thought is this. If power is really free, then I think, I mean, if I were sure of that, I'd right now buy up the state of Nevada. Because then you would put in San Francisco Bay, or whatever it's called at that time, a good, big, monstrous still to distill the salt waters of your bay. And you'd take the salt out and give it back to the fishes, or use it better to establish a large chemical industry here that you need, and take the distilled water, free for nothing, because the heat costs nothing, you understand, and pump it through pumps that also cost nothing to operate, up over the Sierras and irrigate Nevada. I tried awful hard to figure a way of making it rain in Nevada by means of the atomic power, but there wasn't any way. But if we have free power, there are all kinds of things that you can do. But I don't think any of us will live to see that day. Now let's get a little more realistic. I want to talk to you, really, about the immediate problem. The problems that will be facing you and perhaps are already facing you as a result of wartime researches. There are hundreds of them. I'll pick a half a dozen, as we have time for, and sketch them for you briefly. I can't teach you much about them, but I hope I can stimulate your interest so that when you come to the page marked Science in one of the magazines that you know which, just don't turn it over. Just read the science page, because there is the story of the birthplace of the future. Now, I have to prove that. At one American university, as a result of this wartime stimulus, we had last year 4,000 men, 3,800 and something, engaged in research in electronics. You've heard that word. You know it's a big industry coming along. Electronics, 5 years ago, was a relatively unrecognized fraction of the science of physics. 4,000 men, though, at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, more men than they had in the student body and the faculty and the janitors and the president all added up together. That's the thing. If suddenly we had too much production, we had just for the sake of keeping our people employed, we had to keep the factories going and dump everything in the ocean or plow it under or give it away to the Chinese or even the Germans or even the Japanese just to keep our factories going, we might have to do that if we don't see this coming. But if we see it coming, we can arrange. We can perhaps get away a bit from the ancient Puritan ideal that we are on this earth only for the sake of working, and can substitute the Californian, the Southern, the Latin, the Oriental tradition that there are many things in life worthwhile besides hard work. A machine is a device. And that goes not only for you in this room, but it goes for everybody. The net total of the result of much of our scientific development has been the democratization of the privileges of the wealthy. Once silk stockings were a sure sign of wealth. Everybody has them, not right now, but they had them before the war and they have them again. Fur coats, any number of luxuries that were reserved for the aristocracy now are the property of every American. And leisure will be one of them. I don't mind saying that quite brazenly before this industrial audience, because your big industry for the future here, the one that is likely to boom fastest and farthest, is contradiction in terms, really, recreation industry. With purchasing power, with time to spend, recreation industry, along with a great many other service industries, are the hope of the future. Let me pass on. Let me get back to my field. Medicine, I want to talk about a little bit, because people don't recognize there either what's happened. You have heard by fine reports from all the fronts what has been done there. Use of blood plasma, use of sulfur drugs, and within the last year or two, the use of penicillin have saved thousands and tens of thousands of lives. I calculated the other day that the things that the doctors have learned from science since the last World War have saved 60,000 lives. I mean, the rate at which our wounded were dying in the First World War, as compared with a much smaller loss of wounded men in this war, means at least 60,000 lives saved. It's been a great triumph. Mostly our major responsible, there are others. Sulfur drugs are not decreasing in importance particularly, although most experts are now insisting that they should be used carefully and in the presence of a doctor, certainly on prescription only. They are not altogether innocent. But penicillin, that's the innocent one, that has never hurt man or beast. Completely harmless. It doesn't even harm the bug, the microorganism that it is supposed to attack, strangely enough. It is injected into your system. It doesn't kill any germs. It only prevents them from multiplying. It only keeps them from reproducing, shall we say. There is a single word for that in science, but I won't use it over the air. And so, if we can prevent the multiplication of the bug, those that are present in anyone's body at any one time, the body itself can take care of, mostly through the white corpuscles. It's a magic drug, and it's only the beginning of a whole series, like streptomycin and tyrosin, others that you haven't heard of yet. They're coming along. It's a big new industry. It's a new phase of agriculture, strangely enough. We are accustomed to growing plants for their chemical products. We grow corn for starch and lemons for juices and things like that. The chemical products produced by plants have been harvested through thousands of generations. This is only a new form of it. Microplants. Little tiny plants that you have to see with a microscope. Molds and bacteria even produce their crops also. And they are now being harvested by 22 great plants in this country and in Canada making penicillin. It's a new profession of biological engineering. And you can encourage your boys and girls to go into biology now. It used to be that when I was a student, that going into biology meant either teaching or being a farmer. But nowadays, biological engineering and the biological industries are moving ahead as the chemical industries did a generation ago. But the real lesson I want to draw from penicillin is still different. Penicillin, sulfur drugs, blood plasma together have saved military lives. They're saving civilian lives and will save many more. They represent a great advance between them all that is represented in an increase of life expectancy. You know, the balance sheet of the medical profession is never kept by the doctors. They sometimes hate to count up what they've done or haven't done. But the life insurance man is hard-boiled. And he expresses the success of the medical profession and its progress in terms of life expectancy. It's always grown as science grew. Back in ancient days, life expectancy of children born in Greece and Rome was only 25 years. The great generals of antiquity we'd now call boys in their teens. Alexander the Great died at 33. Nobody thought he was a young man at all. He was an old man in Greece. 100 years ago, life expectancy in this country was 40 years. At the beginning of this century, it was 50. Now it's 65 years. And when these advances of wartime medicine come to us, there'll be another jump of 10 years more. So it'll be 75 years. So that babies born in the year 1950 will, on the average, live to be 75 and will therefore live to see the year 2025. On the average. Think of what it means in our own lives. I expect to benefit by it myself, and many in this room do. It means many more people who are surviving when they didn't in former generations. In 1900, we had less than 2 million people in this country of 65 years or older. Now we have 7.5. And when these advances of wartime medicine impinge upon us, we shall have, by the year 1960, 20 million people 65 years or older. Now, that's, we'll get out a lot of pencils in the life insurance offices, I know. But it'll have lots of consequences. What'll we do with 20 million people living on Social Security? We haven't ever thought of such a world as that. Think of what it means to the Republican Party. We have qualifications for holding office and for voting on the bottom side. It may be that as we go down the scale and begin to get irresponsible and enjoy life after 65, maybe we shouldn't even vote. It'd be a great relief for some of us. Social problems galore. Are we going to put all these people into old ladies and old men's homes? If so, we better start building them now. I don't think we will. Certainly that wouldn't be the answer in this state. No, as a matter of fact, I think there's another advance of medicine coming along there. It's been neglected in war, but the great objective of medicine after the war will be in the field of hormones. Those mysterious chemicals that are produced by glands and that affect our lives. I see by the grins that some of you have been reading for it, please say. Well, don't take him too seriously, because we haven't yet seen how long Paul DeCreef is going to live. But it's worth reading. And, the objective, you see, is much better than just postponing death. Much better objective. Postpone senility. That's what we want. Add those 10 years, not on the end, but in the middle, where they'll do some good. We'd have some changes. Well, we can see them coming, gentlemen, and if we take a look at what goes on in the laboratories, these are just a few examples. There are so many more. I wish I could discuss for a while the development of the plane, because here on the West Coast you are so conscious of the needs of the plane. There the problem will be not the fact that we have planes that go 500 miles or more an hour, nor is it very important in my mind that there isn't any spot on the whole globe that's more than 60 hours flying time from San Francisco. What's more important is the number of planes, the air-mindedness of the public, the tens of thousands more of pilots. The fact that Pan American is already providing 60,000 round-trip seats a year to South America, that they've announced flights from New York to London in 9 hours at a low cost comparable with steamship costs. The mobility of the American public due to the plane is a thing that you need a great deal of study on. The change in our vacation habits, if you tie this together with the idea of leisure I gave you a moment ago, tied to that, the advance in the plane, and you'll find people having summer homes in Alaska, in Newfoundland, even in the I was going to say Argentine for the present, I better say Brazil. And later, I hope, in the Argentine, too. It will make enormous difference in the accessibility of the isolated spots. After all, what you want for a vacation is a spot that is completely isolated that nobody can get to. But you have to get there. And the plane, I think, is the answer. I'm quite sure that the plane will do an enormous business in take an enormous lot of business away from the railroad. But not net. The railroad, in turn, will take an enormous amount of business away from the truck and the bus. I doubt whether our highway civilization will come back to where it was. With the development of private planes and ubiquitous aviation, easy and cheap. I wish I had time to talk to you about the synthetic rubber industry, the great new soft plastics industry that is being built upon it, and its connection with the Orient. Sometimes I wish the Japanese had cut down the rubber trees in the Orient, because maybe we shall be blamed for ruining the economy of the East Indies by being able to make synthetic rubber out of petroleum at 10 cents a pound. I don't think we'll ruin it quite, but it'll certainly make a big difference. I come from Iowa, I'm proud to say, gentlemen, and there, certainly, we can't conceive of making synthetic rubber out of anything but corn at $1 a bushel. But in that case, synthetic rubber costs 75 cents a pound. That's out. But the petroleum industry has an enormous future in the chemical field, starting off with synthetic rubber. I can't talk about all those things. I just have another minute, so let me sum up. Some of you men don't like these prospects. You all look eager enough. I know you have concern. But that won't stop progress at all. If your hair is getting gray, gentlemen, don't trust yourself. You don't like these things, but that doesn't matter. It's what the youngsters like that counts. No businessman, no planning committee, state, national, local, or industrial, or commercial, should ever forget it. Listen to the youngsters. They have the future in hand. The world is always changed. It's perfectly normal. It's a part of the order of nature. We had one time no California, no human race, no earth, no sun. In the course of time, it all came, but slowly. Now we are organized for 100,000 men spending $1 billion a year. Their real objective is changing the way we live. And I can't possibly outline all the consequences to you in the short time at my disposal. Let me urge you, then, to keep an eye on the laboratory, and let me urge you again that this is not a thing that anybody can do alone. These laboratories are operated by the government, by the universities, therefore by you. The great progress in the atomic bomb and atomic power is now the property of the people of the United States. I hope that the secret of the bomb itself can be turned over to the United Nations, because it won't be a secret very long. But atomic power is a big thing, and all of us need to keep an eye on it and keep a hand in it. If it is not to be done by the United States government, then it must be done by the United States, working individually, to be sure, working as what you like to call private enterprise, but nevertheless, working together. We've got to get together. And then the resources of science could make this a wonderful world. Perhaps I've been too much in earnest, gentlemen, but I am innately so, and the real interest that I see in all your faces has encouraged me to talk right down to the very last possible second. And so I thank you.